Osho, the Diamond Sutra, talks on Vajracchedika Prajna Paramita Sutra of Gautama the Buddha, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 10.
The first question. Bhagwan, even in my relationship with you, words become less important all the time. Why would a Buddha and a Bodhisattva need to talk at all? What you are talking about what talk, it never happens. Nobody has said anything and nobody has heard anything. The Diamond Sutra has no sutras in it, Mahasattva. That's why it is called the Diamond Sutra. It is an utter emptiness. If you get caught into the words, you will miss the message. The Diamond Sutra is absolutely empty. There is no message in it. There is nothing to read and nothing to hear. It is utter silence. If you read something in the Diamond Sutra, you have missed it. If you find some doctrine in it, some philosophy in it, then you must be imagining. It must be your dream. Buddha has not talked. Neither Subhuti has heard anything. In that non-talking and non-hearing, something has happened. Something which is beyond words. Ananda has tried to capture that for you in words. But it was not in words delivered. It was a communion between two emptinesses. Just you go to the sea and you see the morning and the fresh air and the sun rays and the waves. And you come home and you relate it to somebody what you have seen. Then you relate only words. The word sea is not the sea. And the word sun is not the sun. And the word freshness is not freshness. How do you commune? You have come back from the beach and your beloved asks, what happens? You bring all that has happened into words. Knowing perfectly well, it cannot be brought, it cannot be reduced into words. Words are so pale. Something has certainly happened between Buddha and Subhuti. Something which is transcendental. Maybe they had just looked into each other's eyes. Something was triggered in the consciousness of Subhuti by Buddha's presence. Ananda is trying to report it for you. You are blind. You cannot see light. You can only hear the word light. So remember, the Diamond Sutra is not a sutra at all. That's why it is called the Diamond Sutra, the most precious. Because it contains no philosophy, no system, no theory. It contains no words. It is an empty book. If you can forget the words and you can go deeper into the gaps between the words, if you can forget the lines and can go deeper between the lines, in the intervals, in the passes, then you will find what has happened. It is not a verbal communication. I am also talking to you. But still, I would like to remember, to remind you that my message is not in my words. You will have to step upon the words to get it. Use the words as a staircase, stepping stones. Remember, stepping stones can become hindrances if you don't know how to step over them. You have to listen in silence to silence. Mahasattva Buddha has not said a single word, neither Vibhuti has heard a single word. It is the compassion of Ananda to make few maps for you. Those maps are not the countries. If you have a map of India, that map is not India. It cannot be. How it can be? But it can be of some limited help to you. It can lead you to the real India. It is like the arrow on the milestone by the side road. It points towards something. This whole Diamond Sutra points towards silence. Hence so many contradictions in it. Because only through contradictions silence can be created. Each word has to be contradicted immediately it is uttered by its opposite. So they destroy each other. And in the wake, silence is felt. The second question. The deeper I fall into myself, the more alone I feel. There is only nothingness. And sometimes looking into your eyes, I get the same feeling of a vast emptiness. If it is natural, if being alone is basic, the very essence of my being, then how could the elusive idea of becoming one, of falling in love with somebody eternally, come into being in the first place? And why is it so painful to become aware that it is an illusion? Please clear my doubts. You are the doubter, and you are the doubt. There is no other doubt. First, when you say the deeper I fall into myself, the more alone I feel. If you have really been falling deeper, you will feel aloneness, but you will not feel I am alone. Because then there are two things, I and aloneness. Then you are not alone. Then there is the experiencer and the experienced, the observer and the observed. Then you are not alone. The other is there. The experience is the other. When you really fall deep into yourself, you will not find yourself. That is the whole thing to understand. It is only on the surface that the waves exist. If you go deeper into the ocean, you will not find waves. Or can you? How can you find waves in the depth? They exist only on the surface. They can exist only on the surface. They need winds to exist. The I can exist only on the surface because it needs Tao, the wind of the Tao, to exist. When you go deeper into yourself, the winds are no more there. Taos are no more there. How can there be I? I and Tao exist in a pair. They are never divorced. Yes, you will find aloneness, but not I-ness. And aloneness is beautiful. Let me remind you again, the word alone means all one. That's how it is constructed, all one. On the surface, you are separate from all. In fact, on the surface, you are lonely because you are separate from the all. In the depth, when you have disappeared, there is no distinction between you and all. All is one. You are no more. Aloneness is. You say, the deeper I fall into myself, the more alone I feel. You must be imagining that you are falling deeper into yourself. The mind can go on playing games. It can play the game of being alone. It can play the game of being in prayer. It can play the game of being in meditation. But if I remains, then you can be certain it is a game. Nothing real has happened. That's why, again, the desire for the other will arise. The I cannot exist alone. It needs the other to support it, to feed it, to nourish it. It will bring you back to the other. That's why when you are lonely, you start thinking of your beloved, of your friend, of your mother, father, this and that, thousand and one things. You create imaginary thous. If a man is put in isolation for more than 3 weeks, he starts talking to himself. He creates the whole dialogue. He himself is divided into I and thou. He becomes two, so the game can be played. I cannot exist separate from the thou. The deeper I fall into myself, the more alone I feel. No, you must be feeling lonely. Never use these two words as synonymous. Loneliness is negative. Aloneness is positive. Loneliness simply means you are missing the other. The other is absent. There is a gap in you. Aloneness means you are present. There is no gap in you. You are full of presence. You are utterly there. Loneliness is the absence of the other. Aloneness is the presence of your eternal being. You say there is only nothingness. No. If there is only nothingness, then there is no problem. If there is only nothingness and nobody to know it, nobody to feel it, then there is no problem. Then from where the doubt? How the doubter can arise? No, you are there. That nothingness is bogus because you are there. How it can be nothingness? It is just your idea. It used to happen in my family when I was a child. I was so lazy. I am still. I was so lazy, utterly lazy, that my family has lost all hope with me. By and by, they started forgetting about me. Because I will never do anything. I will sit in the corner and sit. Either with closed eyes or with open eyes. But I was so absent to them that by and by they became oblivious towards me. Sometimes it will happen that my mother will need something from the market, vegetable or something. And I will be sitting in front of her and she will say, nobody seems to be present here. She is just sitting in front of me and talking to me. Nobody seems to be here. I want somebody to go and fetch vegetables from the market. And I am sitting in front of her and she says, nobody is here. I was counted as nobody. Even if a stray dog will enter in the house, I will allow. I was sitting on the gate and the dog is entering and I will watch. And my mother will come rushing and she will, nobody is here to prevent this dog. And I am sitting there. By and by they have accepted that I am as if not. But that does not make much difference. I am there. I have seen the dog come in. I am hearing their words. I know I can manage to go to the marketplace and fetch vegetables for her. And I will laugh at the whole idea that she goes on saying that nobody is here. That's what is happening to you. You are there. And you say nothingness is. You are oblivious of yourself. You don't take note of yourself. Otherwise, you are there. If you are not there, who is saying that nothingness is? Then there is nothingness when you are not there. Then there is pure nothingness. In that purity is nirvana, enlightenment. That is the most valuable place to be. The most spacious place to be. It is the space everybody is searching for because it is unlimited, infinite. And its purity is absolute. It is not polluted by anything. Even you are not there. There is light and there is consciousness. But there is no I. I is like ice, frozen consciousness. Consciousness is like melted ice, liquid. Or even better, even water has evaporated, has become invisible. And you say, and why is it so painful to become aware that it is an illusion, the other? It is painful because the I starts dying. To recognize the other as the illusion, to recognize love as illusion, is very hard. Because then the I starts dying. If you drop the you, the I cannot exist. And you don't know the beauty of dropping the I. And you ask if it is natural, if being alone is basic, the very essence of my being, then how could the elusive idea of becoming one, of falling in love with somebody eternally, come into being in the first place? It came only because of that. Because aloneness is basic, essential. The Hindu scriptures say God was alone. Just think, just visualize God alone and alone and alone for eternity. He became fed up with his aloneness. It was monotonous. He wanted to have a little play. he created the other and started playing hide and seek. When you are tired of the play, when you become fed up with the play, you become a Buddha again. You again drop your ties. They are created by you. The value is imagined by you. You have put the value in them. The moment you withdraw your value, they disappear. You are again alone. The Hindu concept is tremendously valuable, significant. It says God was alone, became monotonous, created the world, the other, just to have a little chit-chat with the other, to have a little dialogue. Then again and again, one comes and feels tired and bored with the other, disappears into oneself, again reaches to one's nothingness, becomes a god. You are all gods who are deceiving themselves. It is your choice. The day you choose not to be this way, you will be free. It is your dream. Because of aloneness, essential quality of your being, the other has been created. You just try, go for a few weeks to the mountains and sit alone. And you will feel very good. Everybody is tired of relationship and fed up and bored, and you go to the mountains and sit silently and you feel so beautiful. But after 3-4 days, 5 days, 7 days, 3 weeks, you start thinking of the other. Your woman again starts being attractive to you. You forget all the nastiness and all the nagging. You forget all that she has been doing to you. You completely forget all. She is again beautiful. She is again lovely. She is again fantastic. You put value again. Then you have to come down from the mountains to the plains. And 2-3 days with the woman, and things are going beautiful. A new honeymoon. And after 2-3 days, things become difficult again. And again you start thinking how to meditate, how to be silent. This is how you go. Just watch your consciousness and its fluctuations, and you will know through it the whole process of existence, because you are a miniature existence. The pendulum of consciousness goes on swinging between meditation and love, between aloneness and togetherness. And because all the religions of the world up to now have been either of love or of meditation, they were fragmentary. They were not total. I am giving you the total religion. I am not choosing. For example, Buddha had chosen meditation. He gives you the love for meditation, no other love. He teaches you only to be alone, absolutely alone and nothing. It is good. It is tremendously good for people who are tired and fed up with the world. He was tired and fed up with the world. He was a king. He was not a beggar. He was tired of women. His father has brought all the beautiful girls from the kingdom for him. He had one of the most beautiful harem. If you get all the beautiful women of the world in your house, how long you will be able to live there? Just think of it. One is more than enough. And all the beautiful women of the kingdom. It must have been maddening. If he escaped, no wonder. All the pleasures were arranged for him. Every kind of pleasure was arranged for him. If he became fed up, no wonder. He moved to the other pole. The other was too much. He escaped into the jungle, became alone. There are religions which are religions of meditation, Buddhism, Jainism. There are religions which are of love, Christianity, Mohammedanism. And this has to be understood. Jesus is a poor man. So is Muhammad. This can't be accidental. Mahavira is a king, so is Buddha. The two kings have given the religion to the world of meditation. And the two poor people of the world have given the religion of love. The poor cannot be fed up with the other. The poor has not that much of the other. The poor hankers for the other. The other may be the woman or the money or power or prestige or God. It makes no difference. The other is needed. Christianity and Islam both are religions of prayer, love. Love for God, prayer for God. In Buddhism and Jainism, there is no place for God at all. Because there is no place for the other. Aloneness is enough. In Jainism and Buddhism, there is no existence of anything like prayer. The word has not been heard. They know only of meditation. Christianity knows nothing of meditation. These are not accidental things. They saw something about the founders. I am giving you a total religion. A religion which allows both. When you are feeling tired with the other, move into meditation. Swing into meditation. When you are feeling tired of aloneness, swing into love. Both are good. Both are contradictory. But through contradiction, great joy arises. If you have only one, you will not have that kind of richness. The one can give you silence, or can give you great joy. But both can give you something infinitely precious, incomparable. They can give you a silent ecstasy, though both together. A peaceful joy. At the innermost core, you remain utterly silent. And on the periphery, the dance. And when silence dances, or silence sings, that is the richest, the peakest of peaks. Hence my insistence for both. George Bernard Shaw, once at a party, was sitting alone at the edge of the room. His hostess came over to him and inquired solicitously, "Are not you enjoying yourself?" Shaw replied, "That's all I am enjoying." He has hit upon a great truth. A great insight is there. One's self is all. Anyone can enjoy life. It starts taking the quality of silence. But if you can enjoy only yourself and never the other, then you will miss the other dimension. One should be capable of enjoying oneself and the other too. That I call the whole man, the holy man. The third question, when I hear your discourses and at other times, I know that I know all that is needed to be enlightened. All those times, am I enlightened? Please comment on how this obviously superficial knowing can penetrate and become beingness. It seems this knowing is robbing me of innocence and more complete experiential realization. That knowledge has far outspaced the growth of my being, and yet, knowing there is no such thing as my being, I don't feel wholly motivated towards growing one. First thing, you say when I hear your discourses and at other times, I know that I know all that is needed to be enlightened. Nothing is needed to be enlightened. So how can you know all that is needed to be enlightened? Nothing is needed to be enlightened. Enlightenment is your natural state. It is not something that has to be produced, manufactured, created. If you are manufacturing something new, then many things will be needed. If you are not manufacturing anything new, what is needed? You are enlightened. How anything can be needed? Nothing is needed. So your idea that you think, I know all that is needed to be enlightened, is barring your way. Nothing is needed to be enlightened, and nothing is needed to be known to be enlightened. Enlightenment is already there, is already the case. It is not a realization, it is only a recognition. It is not that you have to make efforts to bring it. All that you need is not to make any efforts. Drop all efforts. And suddenly it is there. You cannot see it because you are continuously making efforts to see it. Your very effort to see it is functioning as a barrier. And you say, all those times am I enlightened? You are enlightened all the times, not when you hear me. Not when you read something from Diamond Sutra. Not only in those moments. You are all the time enlightened. From the very beginning to the very end, you remain enlightened. You can go on deceiving yourself that you are not enlightened as long as you want. But all the same, you are enlightened. It is like a man who is pretending to be a woman in a drama. He is all the time man. He can go on pretending. Sometimes even he may forget if he is a good actor. Really good actor, he may get into the idea and forget about it. For a few moments he may think that he is a woman. But again and again, he will know that he is a man. It is a miracle that you forget that you are not enlightened, that you go on forgetting it. But you are enlightened. Remember, enlightenment is not a quality that is going to happen to you in some future. You have brought it from the very beginning. It is in your breathing. It is in your heartbeat. It is the stuff you are made of. At those times, am I enlightened? No. If you think that sometimes you are enlightened and sometimes not, then you are not enlightened. The day you know, the moment you know, you are always enlightened, then you are enlightened. Once you have felt enlightenment, it is always there surrounding you like an aroma. Still you can go on playing 1001 games. I'm playing. Buddha is playing. But that does not make any difference. Then it is with full awareness that the game is played. It does not entangle. It does not imprison. Once you play a game knowingly that it is a game, then there is no problem. Then you can be in the world. Then you can be whatsoever you enjoy to be. But deep down, you know you are not that. Deep down, you remain far away. You become a lotus flower in the water, and yet the water touches you not. At those times, am I enlightened, you ask? Please comment on how this obviously superficial knowing can penetrate and become beingness. Superficial knowing can never become beingness. Even deep and profound knowing can never become beingness. Knowledge itself is the obstacle. Knowing can never become being. Superficial or profound. Don't make these distinctions. These are tricks of the mind again. It is the knowledgeable mind. Is the knowledgeable mind can say to you, it is right, superficial knowledge cannot give you enlightenment. But what about profound knowledge? This again, a trick is played on you. Profound, then certainly you are caught again in the same net. Profound or not profound. Knowledge as such is superficial. The profoundest knowledge is superficial. To know is superficial. To be is to be. In that profoundness you are talking about, you will have to be aware. Mind is very cunning. It can accept many things and again bring them back from the back door. It can say, right, I agree perfectly with you. How can superficial knowledge give you enlightenment? That is not possible. I will show you the way of how to get profound knowledge. What you will do to get profound knowledge? It will be superficial knowledge. Again, because knowledge is superficial. At the most, you will have more superficial knowledge. The quantity will grow, and through the quantity, you will have the illusion that you are becoming profound. You may go into deeper details, but details don't lead you to depth. You can know one thing about one thing or 1,000 things about that one thing. It makes no difference. Knowledge is about and about. It never hits the point. It never reaches the target. The target is reached only by being. And to be, knowledge has to be dropped. Absolutely, totally, with no conditions, with no choice, that this is good, keep it, and that is bad, drop it. This is profound, keep it, and that is not profound, drop it. If you keep anything from knowledge, you will remain unenlightened. And the wonder of wonder is that you are enlightened and you go on remaining unenlightened. The question is from Chipper Roth. Must be a newcomer to this place. Must be an outsider. Be here. We will take away your knowledge slowly, slowly. My whole work consists of making people ignorant. Ignorance has depth. Ignorance has innocence. Ignorance is profound. Not knowing has no limits to it. Knowing is always limited. How it can be profound? Howsoever great your knowledge, it will have a limit, a boundary to it. Only ignorance has no boundary. They say that science is an effort to know more about less and less. If you go on and on with this approach to know more and more about less and less, what will be the end? The end will be you will know all about nothing. That will be the logical conclusion. I would like to say that religion is just the opposite approach. To know less and less about more and more. And what will be the ultimate result? One day, you go on knowing less and less about more and more. One day, you know nothing about all. And that is the experience. To know nothing about all. That's what I call ignorance. Rath, please be here a little longer. Hang around. The fourth question. I am enjoying the play very much these days. A very masterful performance this morning. Every morning I wait eagerly wondering what the curtain's rise will bring. I overflow with you, but it brings laughter, not tears. Where are the tears? Suchita, they are in your laughter. Laughter and tears are not different. There are two types of people, the tear people and the laughter people. There are always two kinds everywhere. The whole existence is divided into duality, man and woman, yin and yang. Positive, negative, day, night, life, death. So is this division, the laughter people and the tear people. The tear people are introverts. They are easily ingoing. And when you go in, the deeper you go in, more and more your eyes will be filled with tears. Suchita, is an extrovert. C is a laughing Buddha. Geet Govind is a tearful Buddha. C is an extrovert, outgoing, a real American. So when something will overwhelm her, she will laugh. And remember always, never imitate anybody. If Geet Govind tries to imitate Sucheta, he will be in difficulty. His laughter will be very poor. And it will look phony. If Sucheta tries to imitate Geet Govind, it will be very difficult to bring tears. And even if she can manage with some artificial aid, they will not be true. They will be false. Extroverts should follow their way. In their life, laughter will be their overflowing energy. Love will be easier for them. Meditation will be a little difficult. For the introverts, meditation will be easier. Love will be a little difficult. Tears will be easier. Laughter will be a little difficult. Never imitate anybody. Just go on your own way. And by you will see a transformation coming. When you have touched the extreme. For example, if you go on laughing, for example, if Sucheta goes on laughing to the utter extreme, tears will come. There will come a moment in laughter when the laughter will start disappearing and tears will come. If Geet Govind goes on crying and crying and crying and tears and tears and tears to the very end, suddenly he will find a change happening. Laughter will arise. The revolution is only from the extreme. Once I was talking to a council of Buddhists. Now to say to Buddhists that the revolution is from the extreme, or the truth is only at the extreme, is very difficult because they believe in the middle way, the golden mean. Buddha's path is known as Madhyam Nikaya, the middle way. I forgot that those are Buddhists. I talked about the extreme and I told them the revolution happens only from the extreme, from the utter extreme. Unless you reach to the other utter extreme, there is no truth. Truth is at the extreme. This or that, but at the extreme. Either love at the extreme or meditation at the extreme. They were patient. Buddhists are patient. They are not like Mohammedans. They will not start fighting. But still, patience has a boundary. One Buddhist could not tolerate, although Buddha has said tolerate. He stood up. He said, this is too much. Have you forgotten completely that Buddha's path is known as the middle path? Then I remembered. And I said, true, I know. But unless you are at the extreme middle, there is no truth. I'm talking about the extreme. It has nothing to do with the middle. If you are at the extreme middle, exactly middle, then again truth. Truth happens only with the extreme. From the extreme, the pendulum swings towards the other polarity. So good, Sucheta, laugh. Laugh to the extreme. One day you will see your laughter is bringing beautiful tears. The sixth question, cannot one declare that one has experienced God? If you have experienced, your very existence will be the declaration. You need not declare. At least you need not ask. If the declaration comes, it comes. What can you do? One who has experienced God will not decide anything. Not even this, that he has to declare or not. One who has experienced God has dropped the mind. Now whatsoever happens, he will be into it. He will be totally into it. If declaration comes, it comes. It came to Mansur. He declared, Anil Haq, I am God. His master, Junaid, told him, Mansur, this is not right. You will get into trouble. I also know, but I have never declared. Because these Mohammedans you know all around, they will kill you. But Mansur said, what can I do when he declares? What can I do? Suddenly he catches hold of me and declares. Junaid was so afraid that he expelled Mansur from his school. He said, you go away. You go somewhere else. You will get into trouble and you will get me also into trouble. But Mansur said, what can I do if he wants to get into trouble himself? What can I do? And he got into trouble. But it was true that he could not do anything. He declared at the last moment also from the cross, Anil Haq, I am God, and laughed. Somebody asked from the crowd, if you can still deny, if you can still say that you were wrong in declaring yourself God, there is still hope you can be forgiven. And he laughed, he said, but what can I do? He declares. And you are asking me, can not one declare that one has experienced God? If God declares, good. If God is not declaring, you please keep quiet. Leave it to him. J. Donald Walters writes, a few years ago, I met a man who was holding forth somewhat drunkenly and with massive self-importance on his version of how the universe ought to be run. I forget how it came about, but I happened to mention that I thought I had met perhaps 6 people in my life who know God. My companion held out a huge, hairy paw. Shake, he cried hoarsely. You just met the 7th. Donald Walters writes that he could not believe that this man has experienced God. Because he thinks, how, if you have experienced God, you will declare so blatantly. Shake, the man cried hoarsely. You just met the 7th. But that is not my opinion. It is possible. Because sometimes God is hoarse, sometimes very polite, and sometimes very hoarse. God comes in all shapes and sizes. Sometimes his hands are very, very smooth, and sometimes very hairy. He comes in all the ways. His ways are mysterious. So if he wants to declare through you, Go to the housetops and let him declare. But if he does not want to declare, and you declare on your own, you will get into trouble. If he wants to get into trouble, that is his business. But don't decide on your own. Otherwise, it will be just an ego trip. Reading this story of Donald Walters, I felt very much for the man who said, "Sick, you are just met the seventh." Walters writes condemningly. He thinks this is not the way. Who will decide what is the way? No one should decide. Who am I to tell you that you should not declare? If he wants to declare, who am I to tell you? Let his will be done. But remember always, it should not be your decision. If you decide to declare, that simply means you have not known. Then the mind is playing the greatest megalomaniac trick. Then the mind is going mad. The seventh question. A dear friend of mine sent a letter to you from the West asking for a sannyas name and then came here before she received an answer and took sannyas here. The names he was given by letter was a totally different kind of name from the one you gave her here. I was very disturbed when I heard about this because I have always thought of my name as my path. I have used it to direct me when I have been confused. What really is the significance of the name you give to us? Veera, all holy cow dung. Don't be deceived by the names. You are always hankering to catch hold of something, to make something big out of nothings. The name I give you are just like lover's sweet nothings. Don't make much fuss about them. In fact, once I have given you the name, never come and ask me about its meaning again because I forget. It is in that moment that I create the meaning around it. Then how am I supposed to remember? I must have given 30,000 names or more. A name is just a name. You are nameless. No name confines you. No name can confine you. They are just labels to be used, utilitarian. Nothing is spiritual in it. But because I pay so much attention to your name and I explain it to you, you get hooked with it. That is just my way of severing my attention on you, nothing else. Just my way of showing my love to you, nothing else. The eighth question, why do I always fall asleep in discourse? Sometimes I can't help comparing myself to those people who sit absolutely still just imbibing you, and that makes me feel like I have so far to go. Especially every time people come up to me after the lecture and say, "Was not it amazing today?" Maybe more would come through to me if I just accept that discourse is a good place for me to sleep. It is the perfect place. You don't be worried about those people who come and tell you. They must be joking. You sleep well. They must be trying to disturb you. They must be trying to create some jealousy in you. They must be really jealous of you, that you are sleeping so well and snoring. And those poor people just sitting. They want to disturb you. Don't be worried. You go on sleeping. You have to go far, but in sleep, nowhere else. The game was drifting off into total boredom when a man in the crowd suddenly burst into a round of applause. The man next to him said, "Why did you do that?" "Sorry," he replied, "I was trying to keep myself awake." You don't know how much difficulty people are having to keep themselves awake. You just go into your sleep, relax into it. If you can accept it totally, that will become a great experience. The mind always creates conflict. If you don't sleep, the mind says, "I'm feeling like it would be good if I can sleep." If you sleep, the mind says, "You have missed something. You should not do this." The mind always creates conflict, friction. It is never happy with anything. Drop that mind. If sleep comes naturally, then allow it. In that very acceptance and the disappearance of the mind, you will be hearing the Diamond Sutra. Patanjali says sleep is just next to samadhi. A good sleep, a deep sleep, and samadhi are different only in one sense. Samadhi has awareness, sleep has no awareness. But awareness can happen into sleep. You don't make trouble for yourself. You don't divide yourself. If sleep is not coming perfectly good, keep awake. But then it will not be an effort. If sleep is coming, then fall asleep. Then don't try to keep yourself awake. And I'm not saying that if sleep is not coming, you have to try to go to sleep. Accept whatsoever is the case. Accept reality as it happens in a certain moment. Be totally in the moment. That's my whole message. To be utterly with the moment. This is desire. I should not be asleep. Why? This is not spiritual. To sit in a discourse and fall asleep. Why? Sleep is perfectly spiritual activity. Great spiritual activity. It is as good as sitting there and thinking. Dreaming is as good. Just a primitive form of thinking. Dreaming. More colorful. Others are thinking, you are dreaming. What is the difference? Dream well, sleep well, relax. One day out of this relaxation, you will start becoming aware and alert. But that alertness will have a different quality to it. It will not be forced. It will not be manipulated by you. It will come. One day, suddenly, in the middle of the discourse, you will open your eyes fresh, young, from the deep sleep. And something, just a word, may go into your being and will transform you. The whole Diamond Sutra was none in it when Hui Neng heard four lines. That was enough. Sometimes a single word from a Buddha is enough. It just goes like an arrow and pierces your heart, and you are no more the same. So don't be worried. Relax well. And if you have relaxed well and you open your eyes sometime, it is possible there may happen the meeting between you and me. And you will be so fresh from sleep, unthinking, not knowing who you are. Don't you know sometimes it happens in the morning? When you wake, it takes few seconds for you to recognize who you are. The mind takes time to come back. Sometimes you cannot even recognize where you are. Suddenly awakened in the middle of the night, everybody will feel who he is, where he is. He will take a little time to gather together himself. So it is possible, sleeping one day in the middle, you hear my shouting. Suddenly you wake up and you don't know who you are. And you don't know where you are. That is the right moment I can enter in you. So don't be worried. Whatsoever happens is good. All is accepted here. I accept you as you are. I have no suits for you. The last question. Why people cannot understand each other's religions? Why there is always so much conflict? The ego. It has nothing to do with religions. Just the ego. Whatsoever is yours has to be the best in the world. Whatsoever is others cannot be the best, cannot be allowed to be the best in the world. Your wife is the most beautiful woman. Your husband is the most beautiful person. You are the greatest man in the world. You may not say so, but you say it in 1001 ways. And whatsoever belongs to you, just like small children people are, small children go on fighting that my daddy can lick your daddy anytime. A small boy was telling to another boy that my mother is a great orator. She can speak on any subject for hours. The other said, that's nothing. My mother is such a great orator, she can speak without any subject for hours. Nobody knows what she is speaking. People go on bragging about their things, about everything, about religion too. Mulla Nasruddin's son asked him, Pop, if a Mohammedan leaves his religion and becomes a Hindu or a Christian, what you would call him? The mullah became very angry and he said, he is a traitor. He should be sought. This is the greatest sin in the world. To change your religion? To betray your religion? He is namak haram. He has betrayed his salt. And the boy asked, and Pop, if a Hindu or a Christian becomes a Mohammedan, Mullah was all smile. Jimmy Carter smile. He said, that is great. That man is wise. That man should be welcomed and respected and honored. He knows what is truth. And he is courageous. He is a convert, my son. Now the thing has changed. If a Mohammedan becomes a Hindu or a Christian, he is a traitor. If a Hindu or a Christian becomes a Mohammedan, he is a convert and he is a great man. and he should be honored and respected. He is wise because he has recognized what is the real religion. That's how our egos function. And that's why religions, rather than bringing peace to the world, have been cause of bloody wars. Many more people have been killed in the name of religion than in any other name. Not even politicians have been able to surpass the so-called religious people in murder. The greatest murderers have been the churches and the mosques and the temples. In the future, this ugliness has to be dropped. It should be immediately dropped. A religion is a personal choice. If somebody does not like the rose flower, you don't kill him. And you don't say that he is ugly. You don't say that he is wrong. You say that is his liking. He does not like the rose flower. It is finished. I like the rose flower. But it is a question of liking. There is no question of truth in it. There is no question of arguing about it. And there is no reason to prove why I don't like the rose. If I don't like, I don't like. If you like, you like. There is no conflict. Religion should be like that. Somebody likes Jesus, perfectly beautiful. Somebody likes Buddha. Somebody likes Krishna. Likings. A religion should not have anything to do with birth. It should be a pure liking. Then there will be no conflict. Then there will be no unnecessary arguing which goes on and on down the centuries. Rather than praying, people have been arguing. The whole energy that they have put in argument, if it was put into prayer, they would have known what God is. But they go on arguing. Great debates continue. And nothing is ever proved, because nothing can ever be proved. If you like Jesus, it is just like you fall in love with a woman. You cannot prove anything. Why? And whatsoever you prove will look foolish to others. If you say, look at her nose, how long, how beautiful. People will say, that looks ugly. That looks ugly. It is out of shape. It is too big. The face is not in proportion. If you say, look at the eyes, so big, so beautiful. And somebody will say, they look frightening. I cannot stay with this woman in the night. Those two big eyes. I'm scared. And they are too big. And not symmetrical. There is no way to prove your liking. Somebody likes Jesus and somebody likes Buddha. This is falling in love. You need not prove. And if you prove, you will look fool to others. That's how it looks. Hindus think people are foolish who are in love with Jesus. What is there in this man? You ask the Hindus. They have a beautiful theory of karma. They say you suffer only if you have done wrong in your past lives. Why Jesus was crucified? He must have done great sins. Otherwise, why? Krishna is not crucified. Rama is not crucified. Why Jesus is crucified? He must have been a sinner. Now the whole perspective changes. You ask the Christian that Krishna plays on the flute. That looks so beautiful. And Jesus on the cross looks so sad. And he will say, what are you talking about? This world is in such a misery. This man, Krishna, must have been of a very stony heart. He is playing on the flute. And people are dying. And people are in misery. And there is death and disease. And this man is playing on flute. And he must have a very, very rock-like heart. He has no heart. If he has had any heart, he would have sacrificed himself for the downtrodden, for the oppressed, for those who are in misery. Look at Jesus. He is the Savior. He died for us so that we can be redeemed. This Krishna looks shallow. But ask the Hindu who follows the Krishna. He will say, what are you talking about? There is no misery. All misery is illusion. And if people are suffering, they are suffering for their sins. Nobody else can redeem them. And the only redeemer that can be of any help is one who brings joy into the world. Only joy is the healing force. How can you redeem? Hindus say if somebody is crying and you sit by the side and you also cry, can you redeem him? Crying is doubled. Somebody is ill and you fall ill in sympathy and lie down by the side. How you are helping? To help, you have to be healthy. You need not fall ill. Krishna is healthy. Krishna is joy. The world is so of misery, that's why he brings his flute. Crosses, everybody is carrying already. What is there in carrying a cross? Everybody is carrying. A flute is needed. Now these are the ways, and everybody can go on arguing for and against. To me, religion is a love affair. It has nothing to do with intellect. It has nothing to do with reason. It is falling in love. With whomsoever you have fallen in love, that is your way. Go through it. That is your door. Love is the door. It is irrelevant with whom you have fallen in love. Love redeems neither Jesus nor Krishna. Love redeems. Fall in love. Love is the only redeeming force. Love is the savior. But your egos. Meditate over this beautiful story. Patrick First, the Irish Pope, was sitting in his office in the Vatican one day, reading the Catholic Herald, when a small article in the Irish section entitled Ricard's Births caught his attention. Holy Mary Michael, said the Pope to his secretary, Cardinal Fitzmichael, do you see this? Be Jesus. And what is that, Monsignor? Said Michael, jumping up from his paperwork. It says the wife of Paddy O'Flynn from Dublin has just presented him with his 56th child, said the Pope. The saints be praised, sir, said Michael. Some miracle indeed, is it not? The Lord's work, to be sure, cried the Pope. And should be commemorated in some way for the unity of the Catholic Church, world faith in general, and the Emerald Isle in particular. Indeed, sir, what exactly do you have in mind? No mind, Michael, replied the Pope excitedly. Action! Go this very minute to the workshop. Have a golden Madonna stuck up. Top priority job. Then run around to the travel agents and book me a first-class return flight to Dublin on Aer Lingus. I myself personally will take the Madonna as a little gift and present it to O'Flynn's. I could do with a little holiday in the old country. The next morning, sharp, Pope Patch clutching the Madonna, the Herald and a bottle of Irish whiskey for the flight, boarded the plane for Dublin. On arrival, he went straight to O'Flynn's home whereupon he was taken to the local pub by one of the family to where the main celebrations were taking place. "Someone to see you dead," yelled the kid to the room full of drinkers. "Tell him to grab a Guinness and come over," a voice replied. The Pope grabbed a Guinness and pushed his way Madonna first into the center of the high-spirited group of inebriates. Some hours and many Guinnesses later, the Pope finally staggered up to Paddy and, thrusting the Madonna at him, slurred, "I would like to offer my sincere congratulations to you." "And who do I have the honor of addressing, sir?" said Paddy, beholding the drunken cleric, Guinness in one hand, Madonna in the other. "Well, you don't know me personally, Paddy, but in fact I am the Pope." "The Pope?" exclaimed Paddy. "And you are in a dangerous place, to be sure. Will you have another little Guinness?" "I will indeed," said the Pope, "if you will just promise me one thing before I do." "For a drinking man," said Paddy, "it will be hard to refuse. I would like you to accept this Madonna as a little gift from us all at the Vatican and take it and put it on the altar of your local Catholic church." "Ah, now, sir," said Paddy, "I will take the Madonna, sir, to be sure, and very grateful I am, but it is on the altar of me local Catholic church I cannot do." "But put it on the altar of my local Catholic church I cannot do." "And why ever not?" said the Pope in amazement, "as a gift to Mother Mary." "Well, the truth is, sir," said Paddy, "I am not a Catholic, I am a Protestant." "What?" screamed the Pope. "You mean to say I have come all this way to present me golden Madonna to a fucking sex maniac?" Enough for today.